motive, sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like Songa, man. My song's gon' break through like
a hello, and bag. Welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. It is Thursday, November 24th, 2022. Happy Thanksgiving to one and all, and especially those of you joining in on the live stream of YouTube tonight. Thank you for spending part of your Thanksgiving with us. Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Mark Daly here. Hammy, how are you tonight, sir?
I am doing fantastic, my friend. Thank you so much for asking. To everybody south of the 49th parallel, happy Thanksgiving. I hope you guys have a fantastic day with your friends and your family. And I hope you have a productive shopping weekend, because, of course, the day after Thanksgiving is Black Friday, followed by Cyber Monday. So hopefully there's some great deals out there, and inflation hasn't impacted those hot electronics you've been eyeing for the last 8 months too badly. But, dude, again, thank you so much, man. I'm doing great. What about you?
Yeah, doing good, thanks. I was just thinking, you know, Thanksgiving, even though, you know, we celebrated Thanksgiving in Canada here about 4 or 5 weeks ago, American Thanksgiving for me is like, it kind of sort of kicks off the whole holiday season, because I guess what'll be the next big one? Will it be Hanukkah in a couple of weeks? I guess so, right? Sort of the beginning of December, I think. You know, I don't have the calendar off the top of my head, but such a great time of year. There's so many wonderful traditions and celebrations going on, so... Yeah, I'm just a little jealous I didn't get any turkey today, but that's soon to come with Christmas just only less, well, just a month today. Well, tomorrow, actually, 25th. But yeah, so no Formula One anymore. That's kind of weird, but well, there is. I mean, there's still plenty to talk about, but the season officially wrapping up last Sunday in Abu Dhabi. And just to recap, the 2022 Formula One World Championship and the Drivers' Championship, we had Max Verstappen finishing 454 points ahead of Charles Leclerc, who had 308. Sergio Perez was 3 points behind with 305. George Russell, 275. Carlos Sainz, 246, 6 points ahead of Lewis Hamilton, who had 240. And then just running down the top five in the Constructors' Championship, Red Bull, 759, Ferrari, 554 points, Mercedes, 515, Alpine, 173, and McLaren rounding out the top five in the Constructors with 159. But Hammy, boy, where did that season go? It feels like it went really, really quick, but when I kind of was going back and kind of going down one by one and just reflecting back on the season, what that was, and some other like personal events and things that coincided with races throughout the season, I was kind of like, wow, some of those things seem like a really, really long time ago now, if we go back to like March or April or May of this year. But just in general, seems like it's gone really, really quick.
Definitely. And I think one of the things I should mention before I kind of delve into one of my lengthy preambles is, one of the things that makes us special relative to a lot of the other Formula One podcasts out there is we will be here at least once a week, every week between now and winter testing. We are not going anywhere. If you want a break from us, too bad. We will be dropping our Friday news show, and we've got a ton of exciting stuff coming up as well, including the fact that we're going to be doing our very first off-topic show this coming Sunday, probably dropping Monday or Tuesday, which should be a lot of fun, and we've had tons of questions and feedback from the audience. So if you just want to learn a little bit more about us and some of our passions and interests and things like that, you can definitely tune into that. But it was an interesting championship, I think, in a couple of ways, that it was always going to be intriguing from the jump simply because we had a new set of regulations and we had some driver changes. Last year, though, it's kind of set the bar for anticipation and climax and suspension that this season was never going to be able to hit. And, you know, we're pretty open with our audience. And I think it speaks to the fact that I think generally the broader interest in the sport sort of started tapering off somewhere around the summer break because the championship was all but decided. I think, though, one of the things you and I tried to do so much is, even if the championship is largely wrapped up, like, look, there's still a ton of other really interesting things happening in the world of Formula One, whether it's driver drama, contract drama, or even just the future of the 2026 engine regulations, which we're going to get into here. But for all of you that might be thinking about taking a break from Formula One for a couple of months, I encourage you not to. We're going to keep coming back every week with great content and lots of news. And again, I want to thank all of you as well. And it's probably a little bit early because we've still got 5 weeks left in the year, but daily. This was our biggest year ever already in terms of
just
total
crazy
downloads for the show. And we can keep building on that. So to everybody that is listening and has listened, and thank you for all the support, because it means the world to both
absolutely.
Of us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been an outstanding year for this show, and looking forward to getting a little bit of rest. I must admit that I love the fact that we're going to do an off-topic show, because it requires almost zero prep compared to like a normal show, relatively speaking, right? But it's going to be fun. I mean, we get to do in the off-season cover some different things that don't necessarily always fit in during the rest of the year. And you've done a great job all season long with the interview series, tracking down and speaking with some fantastic people in the motorsport world, not always necessarily Formula One related, but I mean, they've been so enjoyable. But even apart from those, there's other things that we want to talk about that don't even necessarily fit in the molds that can be tacked on into one of these sort of like bonus weekly shows.
Right.
So that's going to be fun to kind of do some of the things that we've wanted to do that have been on the side burner basically all season long on the to-do list. But
I was talking last night to one of our great listeners from Texas, Joe Santucci, and we were talking a little bit about the show. And by the way, shout out to Joe. He and his wife had a baby on the 11th of November.
Oh,
congratulations.
Awesome.
But I was talking about the fact that there's so much more you and I want to do. We're just so time starved. So I think one of the things that I've been doing is really trying to map out the next couple of months in terms of what we're going to do with the show. So we will be here every week, but we do still have some interview series shows coming up. In fact, we have a young driver that has agreed to come back on the show for another interview, and she's going to bring her dad, who was a big part of her development in motorsports growing up. So that should be a fun podcast as well. But we've got lots and lots of really good stuff, lots of good stuff coming up.
So do we tell them now that we're also, just because we're completely about the numbers and stuff like that, that I'm going to interview 1 week, you're going to interview me, I'm just kidding. That's kind of, but I guess we're kind of doing that in a way when we do
the off-topic show.
Yeah.
So, by the way, I've started putting together the agenda for that. And some of the topics so far include your favorite chicken sandwich, your favorite 90s TV sitcom. I'm going deep here. Your most hilarious moment with one of your children. So people are going to learn a lot about us, and it'll probably also help illustrate just how old we are relative to much of our audience. But my friend, I have people that have been asking.
That 90s sitcom one?
Go on.
I'm thinking about that one already, just to go off topic.
So obvious.
I mean, there's so many we can do with that. But you know what? I'm gonna stop it right there, and I'm gonna tease everyone about that.
People have to come. You have to
come back. Yeah. Don't want to give out the good material before we even sit down and do the off-topic show.
We're teasing. I think this is what we call like a professional tease. So my favorite chicken sandwich is tune in next Monday to find out. But dude, before we go on, you gave a championship update, but we have people dying to know the final F1 fantasy league super standings. Should I share them? I'm going to go in reverse order today. So remember, the top three finishers are going to get prizes. So if you are in fact one of the top three, because I'm having trouble identifying two of them on our Twitter followers list, but if you are one of the top three, please reach out to us via Twitter DM and we'll organize to get you your prize. Starting number 10 from the UK, Daffy A. Number 8. Wow. Merck Stappen. Number 8, tied for number 8 from the UK, Marshall W. Number 7, Radic W. Number 6, Brian W. Number 5, Thaddeus F. And number 4, Janko West. And here we go, breaking in to the top 3. Number 3, Whitman R. from the UK. Number 2, Aaron K. And finally, number 1, we should all have expected this, Andrew T. just ultimately decimated the field.
Awesome.
So we kept talking about how close it was. Well, it was close up until the last two races. He finishes the season about 150 points ahead of the second place, Aaron K. So congratulations to all three of you. Thank you to the almost 2,300 people that competed in the fantasy league this year. That was unbelievable. I finished 356, so not particularly well. We'll definitely reboot this next year. It was a lot of fun. But for the three of you, please reach out to us via Twitter DM so we can make some arrangements for you.
Cool. And next year, I'll have to make sure that I submit a team to our own fantasy league because this year
can
I was
you please?
Caught. that was just embarrassing. It's just like you reminded me plenty of times, and then I'm like, I'm going to sit down and like, oh shoot, the deadline passed, and I'm not going to be able to register for the podcast's official fantasy league. That's not one of my better moments, but oh well. There you go. There's always next year. Okay, moving right along then. 101 days until the 2023 Bahrain Grand Prix. And if you're looking for something to do in those 101 days, the perfect thing to do is get in on the Race Weekend magazine. Magnus Greaves and his team, good friends and supporters of this show, and use our promo code ScuderiaPod, get 10% off. Great Christmas gift for that Formula One fan out there. So we'll just throw that out. And well, I've sort of gotten ahead of ourselves here because we already mentioned the off-topic program dropping in a couple of days. So let's go on to some records. So Max and Red Bull broke quite a few records this past year in 2022. So most wins by a driver in a season, Max, was 15. You remember back in the day when there was like 16 races in a season? That's just insane.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't that long ago.
Relatively, right? Yeah, yep. That's insane. So most points by a driver in a championship with Max's 454. Largest points deficit overturned to become champion. Max Verstappen again with 46. Wins from the most different grid slots in a year, 7. Most wins in a season outside of pole position, 9. And most consecutive finishes in the top 2, Red Bull, who had 19. Wow, That's crazy. Those are some mind-blowing Mercedes-style stats. So it's going to be really, really interesting next year, what with them having that, the penalty imposed on it for the cost cap overspend, plus the automatic reduction and all the testing and development that they can do in general. And the fact that we've kind of seen Mercedes and Ferrari at different times during the year, they've kind of had some glimpses. So going into 2023, get another, 1 year with these new cars under our belt, it could become a very, very, very interesting season in 2023.
By the way, shout out to motorsport.com for those statistics, and also from motorsports.com, despite the fact that Red Bull absolutely racked up. I think it's not raked, it's racked up. Is that what you say? Racked up?
Racked up,
yes. Despite
the
fact that they racked up a ton of great records and accomplishments this year, there were some that got away. So here's a couple of the they just missed. The biggest championship winning margin, the record is 155 points. That was Sebastian Vettel over Fernando Alonso in that incredibly dominant 2013 season. Of course, this year, Max beat Charles Leclerc by 146 points, who just missed that record by 9 points. The most wins in a year by a constructor, the record for wins was 19 wins of 21 races. That was Mercedes in that 2016 season. Of course, that battle between Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton. This year, of course, like you just said, they scored 17 wins in 22 races. And then most points in a year by a constructor. The record was, of course, Mercedes that same year, 2016. They scored an astonishing 765 points. And again, that was 21 race season. And of course, this year in a 22 race season, Red Bull scored 759 points. So a couple of records that were just outside their grasp.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing though. Just to hear those other records are really, really mind blowing as well. So before we get into some of the news tonight, let's just, now that the dust has sort of started to settle after the end of the season and silly season is officially over until, basically 3 days from now, it'll boot up again for next year, who's going where and who's out of contract and all that fun stuff. But confirmed for 2023, Red Bull will field Max Verstappen and Sergio Perez. Ferrari also unchanged with Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz. Mercedes also unchanged with Lewis Hamilton and George Russell. Over at McLaren, you're going to have Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, who's sliding in to replace Danny Ricciardo. Over at Alfa Romeo, still the same with Valtteri Bottas and Guan Yu Zhou. And then Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon, new pairing at Alpine. And then over at AlphaTauri, Nick DeVries will partner Yuki Tsunoda, so another new pairing there. Another new pair of drivers is the journeymen of Kevin Magnussen and Nico Hülkenberg at Haas. And Fernando Alonso will partner up with Lance Stroll at Aston Martin. And then finally, Logan Sargeant will partner up with Alex Albon over at Williams.
And so we'll talk a little bit about Logan Sargeant later in this podcast.
Awesome. So another interesting little bit of news to filter out via Adam Stern. Apparently, the president over at the Vegas Grand Prix and CEO Steve Hill thinks that there might actually be a possibility to host a NASCAR street race on the Vegas Strip with along with some other events if the F1 race in Vegas next year, which will debut for the first time, is a success. So this could be very, very interesting. I mean, is as intrigued and as excited as I am to see Formula One rumbling around the streets of downtown Las Vegas down on the Strip, I have to admit that the thought of NASCAR, and I'm not even really very familiar or necessarily a fan of NASCAR at heart, I'm very, very intrigued by the by this prospect. So I don't know, Hammy, if this will actually come off, but what do you think about that? Is that something you'd be interested in or excited to watch?
Yeah, very much so. I think NASCAR is doing some interesting things to broaden its appeal. And I don't know if you saw, but they ran an exhibition earlier this year in the LA Coliseum, which is just incredible. But I think expanding their scope, getting into new markets and experimenting with more road courses is something that they're looking to broaden their appeal. And of course, we've talked earlier this year. And of course, when we had Amber Belkin on the show, we talked about all of the things that they're doing to diversify their audience and diversify the folks that are getting in the car to drive those stock cars around the track and around the street. So yeah, kudos to NASCAR because they're being very, very creative and they're trying to find ways to broaden their appeal and grow their sport, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And just quickly here before, because I know we're going to talk about Fernando in a minute, but Connie in the live chat just asked, what's the over-under and how many races before Fernando Lance gets toxic next season?
Winter testing, man.
I was going to say that, but I thought even by my standards, that was too overly cynical, but he stole the words literally right out of my mouth.
I have some thoughts about Fernando and Stroll, but we're going to talk about Fernando a little bit later, so I'll save them for then.
Save it for then. Okay, just to kind of wipe the slate clean here, then according to Joe Pompliano, the average Formula One race this past season had 1.21 million viewers in the U.S., which is new viewership a record. In 2020, that was 607K. 21 was 949,000 per race. And then this year was 1.21 million, which is just amazing. So compare that to NASCAR. Average race viewership in the USA is 3 million. Indy is 1.3 million. And that includes the Indy 500. So very, very interesting there.
Yeah, just to add to that real quick too, because I thought I did a little bit more half-assed internet research on this one, but American races are super important. So the average was 1.21. Miami drew 2.6. Canada drew 1.4. COTA drew 1.6. And Mexico drew, I think, somewhere in the range of 1.2 million. So that number is impressive because almost all Formula One races are in Europe or Asia or the Middle East, which aren't even remotely in a North American time zone. So the fact that they average 1.2 million races when there's only five races currently in the continent is pretty impressive, right? Like NASCAR, 3 million, that's great, but every single race happens in one of the three North American time zones. So that's a pretty impressive number and it continues to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, why don't we just break a little bit early here, because coming up, we're going to talk about 2026. So this is something I think we're going to probably want to dive into. So just hang on for a moment, guys. So we're going to take a quick break and just step away from a word from our sponsors. So don't go away. We'll be back on the flip side. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, welcome back. And it is time to talk about, who else? Porsche and Honda. So we had a deadline passed just about over a month ago with the deadline for new registrants for the new engine formula coming in 2026. So at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, FIA President Mohammed bin Sulayem proudly announced, quote, two more have signed and others will follow, end quote. So Mercedes and Red Bull powertrains confirmed a day later that they are on board for 2026. So there was a second registration deadline that expired on November 15th. And bin Sulayem said, yeah, it's kind of a deadline, but that that this deadline date is somewhat fluid and moving. So, you know, it is a complex set of rules that all the potential entries and all the teams and the manufacturers have to study carefully. Renault's been looking at it. Alpine boss Laurent Rossi announced that Renault will be signing up in the next couple of weeks after they have some legal questions clarified. So Ferrari isn't quite there just yet. Maranello said that they see the need for renegotiations, not only some of the financial issues, but also the increased entry fee and the price of customary engines. Ferrari is worried about whether or not the FIA can actually fairly control the budget cap for everyone and how newcomers will be preferred and what status Red Bull powertrains will get if Red Bull's new engine factory joins forces or partners up with another engine manufacturer at some point. So RB Powertrains is about 90% certain to be joining up at some point. So it's interesting, though, because Ferrari wants to know, for example, what happens if RB Powertrains has some sort of partnership or some sort of, you know, or just gets together with Honda in 2026 and what's going on there. So Honda is expected to be signing up for this new engine formula from 2026. And, you know, this is, you know, interesting to see what's going to happen because, I mean, they've sort of been out and in and then out and in again. Anyways, there's also a bit of a rumor that that Ford might be partnering up with Red Bull. So, Hammy, this is kind of, I know you love all this sort of stuff. So why don't you pick it up from here?
Yeah, first of all, shout out to you. The fact that you're reading and translating a story from a German magazine on the fly is pretty impressive. So shout out to Michael Schmidt at AMUS for this. But yeah, so we had a deadline, just like you spoke to. Originally, it was October and it got bumped to November. And any manufacturer that was intending to provide or to produce power units for the 2026 season, which is when the new engine regulations come in, they had to commit by a certain deadline. And just like you said, the FIA, Liberty are super fluid and they're super flexible on this because it behooves them to get as many manufacturers in as possible. And what we know so far is Audi was the first to commit, Mercedes committed, Red Bull powertrains committed, Renault is about to commit, and Ferrari's kind of teetering because they want to kind of dot their I's and cross their T's. But what's expected now is that Honda is absolutely going to commit to the 2026 power unit formula. There is not an immediate association to a team. We know that they probably will not partner with Red Bull powertrains, which is remarkable because, of course, they're going to continue to supply Red Bull powertrains, with engines right until the end of the 2025 season. But Honda, it looks like, will be coming back to F1. So at the end of 2020, you and I were sitting here. We were crying. We were weeping that Honda was leaving the sport. Here they are, on the verge of recommitting to Formula One for the 2026 season, when, of course, we're going to have highly electrified engines and engines that run solely on synthetic fuel. So that is incredible. Now, the intriguing part about this, of course, is not that Honda's coming back, and there's no expectation that they're going to come back as a manufacturer, although, of course, that's always possible. But the expectation is that they're going to come back as a supplier to a team and possibly partner with one of the existing teams on the grid in a works partnership. So when you look at the teams that are currently being supplied engines from another manufacturer, of course, you have Haas, who's getting their power unit from Ferrari. That relationship's not about to change. We know Sauber is now a partner and will be the works team for Audi. So that's not a good fit. We have McLaren, who's buying their engines from Mercedes. And we know that's not in their best interest because, of course, they have to develop a car and build an aerodynamic philosophy that's compatible with the engine that's being fed to them. So McLaren could be an interesting partner for Honda. And of course, if you told us that 6 years ago, we would never in a million years believe that that could be the case. And of course, Williams would love to have a works partnership with a manufacturer like Honda. So I would expect that if Honda comes back, it would probably be in a partnership with McLaren, a partnership with Williams. And I wouldn't even say a partnership with Aston Martin would be completely impossible, but very, very intriguing. And then the other piece that you commented on as well is, and we've been hinting at this for a couple of weeks now, that there was an American manufacturer that had been sniffing around the FIA in some of these meetings because they were curious or interested in getting involved. And if Ford comes in and they link up with Red Bull and Red Bull powertrains, their role could be pretty small. It could just be adding some technical expertise and some funding and some financing and helping to support from the electrification side, because we know that Red Bull powertrains currently has 300 people working in their factory, working in their power unit factory in Milton Keynes, just on the internal combustion engine. And they have an operating internal combustion engine already. So if Ford was able to come in and add some funding and expertise to help with the electrification of that power unit, that could be pretty cool. So very, very interesting. And of course, Porsche, who has not yet committed, could still, although it seems based on some of the feedback coming from Germany that they're probably no longer interested in developing their own power unit, that they would probably just rebadge something that's produced by Audi or do something in collaboration with Audi. But there's still a possibility that Porsche commits. So we could have Audi, Mercedes, Red Bull, Renault, Ferrari, Honda, Ford, Porsche. Like, we could have 6-7 different engine manufacturers on the grid, which would be simply incredible. And what that could do, what that should do, is significantly increase competitive balance. Because the challenge today is, if you are a customer team and you are buying your power unit from another manufacturer, the likelihood that you're going to win a championship, any championship, is very, very, very low, because the development of that power unit should be in close collaboration with the development of the car itself. And if you're McLaren or if you're Williams, you're basically having a power unit thrust upon you, and you have no input into its design. You have no input into its characteristics or its cooling package. Basically, you have to build a car to accommodate somebody else's power unit, and that's not a desirable state. So if McLaren was partnered with Honda or Williams was partnered with Honda, you effectively get an extra works team on the grid, which would be very cool. So all of this is very, very exciting. The other thing that I should mention as well is there's a little bit of anxiety in the paddock about Red Bull powertrains. And by that, what I mean is when a manufacturer is developing one of these 2026 power units, they're being given an allocation of money that they can spend in 2023, 24, and 25 to develop these power units, right? So if I am Ferrari, if I am Red Bull powertrains, if I am Williams, outside of the cost cap, outside of the money that the teams can spend building a car, the actual engine manufacturers, the engine suppliers, the power unit suppliers, also have a cost cap. And that cost cap is significant in 23, significant in 25, and it declines somewhat for 2025. So these teams are being given budgets of tens of millions of dollars a year for the next couple of years to develop these power units. Now, what the FIA and Liberty is trying to do is create concessions for new engine suppliers. So for instance, if an engine supplier like, I don't know, Hyundai came along or Ford came along and they wanted to develop their own power unit, the FIA would give them concessions, which would mean that they would have additional funds available to them in 23, 24, and 25 to invest in developing that power unit, Plus, they would get extra dyno hours, and dyno hours are the engine equivalent of wind tunnel time. So for these new engine suppliers, they're being incentivized to get involved in the sport because they're giving extra funding and extra dyno hours to develop those power units. Now, what's happening is Ferrari and some of the established teams are a little bit frustrated with Red Bull because Red Bull is presenting Red Bull power units as a new entry and believe that they should get the additional funding as part of their increased power unit cost cap. Mm. That these established manufacturers aren't. So there's a little bit of anxiety because Ferrari's saying, no, 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 Red Bull powertrains. 2026 isn't your first year in the sport. 2022 was the first year in the sport because technically your engines are badged Red Bull powertrains and you have a factory employing people. So there could be a little bit of conflict there where Red Bull's saying, hey, no, we're new for 2026. And Ferrari and Mercedes and some of these other established teams saying, no, 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 no. Technically, you are not a new entity for 2026, even though, of course, their 23, 24, 25 power units are effectively being supplied out of Japan from Honda.
Yeah, I know. And I think that's where they're going to try and play that kind of like gray area, right? Is that
exactly, the fact that
they're like, okay, that this is basically a rebadged Honda engine until the end of 2025. And we're not allowed to carry that IP forward, that basically that's overdone with as of December 31st, 2025. And then we're on our own from after there. So you can kind of see how both sides are going to play,
totally.
Right?
Which yeah. By the way, is another reason those Honda badges suddenly miraculously reappeared on those cars, on the Red Bulls at the Japanese Grand Prix, because they need to be able to provide evidence and proof that this is in fact an engine supply deal and that Red Bull powertrains isn't really associated with the power units that are in the current cars.
Well, I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, a couple of years ago, they had Renault engines rebadged as Tag Heuer, right? And I mean, this is it. Yeah. And this has been something that's been done in Formula One for a very, very long time. So be interesting to see how that unfolds, but also equally interesting to see what perhaps Ford might do. I mean, I know like you were saying that it just might be sort of like a little bit of technical support here and there, but be interesting to see if they could, you know, if they wanted to scale it up from there. And also apparently Hyundai isn't completely out of the picture yet. I mean, that's a name that keeps popping up, but I suppose what I've been reading anyways is that it's not likely that they would enter before 2027. And apparently they would have to, I believe their quote unquote deadline is June 30th, 2023. So they've got about 6 or 7 months to make up their mind to decide whether or not they're going to get on board with that for 2027. Okay, moving along. So Formula One has announced an all-new series to begin in 2023. So this is this is good. This is great news because the W Series obviously did not make it all the way through the season. They canceled the last several races because of a lack of funding, and I think this is great news. So they've officially announced the formation of a new all women series, which will begin in 2023. The F1 Academy will be run and financially backed by the sport's new owners, Formula One Management, with the intent of helping more young women progress in motor racing and ultimately into Formula One. So the new championship will have 5 teams. Each team will have 3 drivers, and that will be run by existing competitors in the existing F1 feeder series, so Formula 2 and Formula 3. And the calendar will be 7 races, with 3 races at each event. And the calendar has not been confirmed, but it will be expected to include at least 1 event coinciding with a Formula One weekend. So Formula One CEO Stefano Domenicali had to say, quote, "Everyone should have the opportunity to follow their dreams and achieve their potential. And Formula One wants to ensure that we're doing everything we can to create greater diversity and roots into this incredible sport." End quote. So there you go. So they've also announced that the new series will be using the Tatis T421 chassis with a turbocharged engine, 165 horsepower, and the combination equivalent to those used in Formula Four championships across Europe. Very, very cool. Hammy?
Yeah, this is fantastic.
Do you think? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's
right?
funny because clearly this would have been in the works a month or two ago when you and I were sitting here bemoaning the fact that the W Series season collapsed yep. because of the lack of financial resources. So this is good. Now, just to be ultra clear, this is not designed to compete with. It is not designed to replace the W Series. It is designed to complement the W Series. So we talk about the W Series effectively representing, say, from a machinery perspective, an F3 quality championship. Like you just mentioned, these will be 165 horsepower turbocharged cars that would be better compared to a Formula 4 car. But what this series is designed to do is fill in that gap between karting and the W Series, or karting and F3. And I think this has generally been identified as one of the biggest gaps in the development of young women when it comes to open wheel racing, that sometimes they're very competitive in karting, but there's nowhere for them to go from there, or there are less opportunities. Even the W Series is a huge jump from karting. So this is designed to identify talented young women and give them the opportunity to compete in a partially subsidized series. So it looks like the actual cost per racer is about $300,000 a year. $150,000 of that will be subsidized by F1. So if you are identified and you are offered a seat in this championship, cost all in is about $300,000 a year. F1 will subsidize $150,000 of that. The driver still needs to supply the rest of that, either out of their own bank account or through funding and sponsorships that they bring with them. So when we often talk about pay driving or pay drivers in Formula One, trust me, everyone in F4, F3, and F2, they are all pay drivers because they do not get paid to drive, and they only get a seat if they bring funding with them. And the same will be the case here. So this is ultimately very, very cool. Jessica Hawkins was interviewed by Top Gear earlier this week about this as well. She is extremely optimistic, not only about the return of W Series, but she believes that this is going to be a terrific, terrific championship, and it will be a great step in helping to get a woman into a position where she can compete in Formula One, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, and Jessica Hawkins, of course, a guest on this program earlier this summer, so very cool. Okay, so moving along to Red Bull, they have now officially confirmed that Daniel Ricciardo will return to the team for next year in the role of a reserve driver or third driver, whatever you want to call it. Danny Ricciardo had to say, quote, "The smile says it all. I'm truly excited to be coming home, back home to Oracle Red Bull Racing as their third driver in 2023. I already have so many fond memories of my time here, but the welcome from Christian Horner and Dr. Helmut Marko and from the entire team is something I'm sincerely appreciative of. For me personally, the ability to contribute and be surrounded by the best team in Formula One is hugely appealing, whilst also giving me some time to recharge and refocus. I can't wait to be with the team and support with simulator work, testing sessions, and commercial activities. Let's go." There you go. So what do you think of this one, Hammy? It's not quite the race seats. The one sort of like key phrase that I pulled out of that one was recharge and refocus. Is this sort of like Daniel's attempt to sort of stay sort of on the radar or as best he can?
Yeah. Perfect way to explain this. One, this is a win-win deal for Red Bull, and let me explain in a minute, but also a win-win deal for Daniel Ricciardo. And it's a win for Daniel Ricciardo because to not be on the grid at all and not be in the paddock at all for an entire season when you're in your mid-30s could be the death blow to your career. So for Daniel Ricciardo to not be on the grid, but be in and around a world-class organization like Red Bull Racing for an entire year is a phenomenal opportunity for him. He gets to reboot. He's familiar with the team, the engineers, the mechanics, the leadership. He's familiar with the factory, the personnel at the factory. This will be very much a homecoming for him. Of course, he won, I think, six races with Red Bull during his time there leading up to the end of 2018. So I think this is a huge win for him. Like you said, it could be a reboot. It could be a way to freshen his career and put him in a really good state of mind. And I just think it'll also help for him to be around world-class capable machinery and to be able to go on the track and practice sessions and in winter testing, driving one of the best cars in Formula One. And it will really give us a good sense of where he is because we'll be able to index his times against, of course, his new teammates, Sergio Perez and Max Verstappen. And for Red Bull, I think this is an incredibly big win because as much I think as Sergio Perez is liked throughout Mexico and through parts of North America and is himself very likable. I think that the team as a whole has a PR image problem. And that stems back, of course, to the outcome of last year's championship. The fact that Christian Horner and especially Helmut Marko don't particularly resonate with younger fans. Of course, the cost cap issue, the recent PR nightmare that happened in Brazil when Max Verstappen wouldn't follow team orders. Like this all of a sudden is a marketing dream for Red Bull because they can now march Daniel Ricciardo out at press events and media events and winter testing. He can be in the paddock on a Grand Prix weekend doing interviews, talking about the team's progress and the success of his teammates. Like this is just a PR dream and a marketing dream for Red Bull Racing. So I think it's a win for Daniel Ricciardo. He gets to be around a world-class organization, perhaps get some seat time, be in the sim. And it's also a big win for Red Bull because it helps to soften their image in light of some of the damaging PR circumstances have surrounded this team in the last few months and years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there was an interesting couple of quotes here, actually quite an extensive quote from Danny Ricciardo in a conversation he had with Speed Cafe. And he said the following, quote, "To make things crystal clear, I'm still not on the grid next year." So this is prior to the confirmation of this third driver role at Red Bull. And he said, Danny goes on to say, quote, "But look, it's certainly a way to still stay involved and give me the time to take a necessary to take a step back. It has been no secret to myself. As the second half of the season went on, I just needed to step away for a bit, rebuild myself, reset a bit, and also just find the intense love for it. Because at this level, if you don't have that, then I'm not doing justice for myself or anyone around me. I'm not saying I've lost it, but I'm in fear of losing it. Obviously, a race drive is the best thing if I want to stay, you know, that's the surest thing. It just became more and more clear that I couldn't be doing 24 races next year. It just wasn't going to, I think, be the right thing for me. I think it would have probably just worn me out more than anything. And it's at a point where I felt just a little exhausted, where I just needed to slow my year down. And at this level of sport, that is dangerous. You can't be operating at 99% even. So I really felt I was in fear of not being at my best if I did another year. Obviously, there were great talks with other teams, and I was like, okay, if I'm not on the grid, at least let me be aligned with the top team, end quote. So there
Daily,
you go.
I got to read.
Interesting, right?
I got to read a quote. I got to read a tweet here from Elizabeth Blackstock because it has me grinning ear to ear. So she tweeted yesterday, and I quote, "Red Bull Racing hiring Daniel Ricciardo as their quote unquote reserve driver just to send him out to do promo stuff is the ultimate PR move. Changed my mind." And then she follows that up with, "If Red Bull Racing had Daniel Ricciardo on the team this year, they'd have sent him out to do a photo shoot with a whole slew of puppies after the Brazil team orders fiasco. And that would have been the only thing we talked about." So yes, like this is a perfect decoy. Like, hey, you know what? We have a team orders incident in Brazil. Look, Daniel Ricciardo with puppies. And it would completely distract us from what's happening on the track. So kudos to Elizabeth for making me smile.
Yeah, that's really, really good. I mean, that's a top level Twitter read right there, right? Yeah, but I mean, going back to Danny himself, yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I mean, he is taking time away from the sport. I mean, let's say at best it's a year out. I mean, it's been done by other people. Let's take a look.
Alex Albon, Kevin Magnussen, Nico Hülkenberg. Fernando Alonso.
Alonso, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess Alonso's probably the best one to compare him to, and then maybe even Nico Hülkenberg. I mean, Fernando, I think, I think he's still driving at an incredibly good level. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how Hülkenberg does, because he's sort of been a little bit in and out of the car over the last, 2 years now? Yeah. Because he's sort of like slotted in as a reserve driver. So, I mean, he's one guy I'm going to be looking at. I mean, it's certainly like your Kevin Magnussen's on up, just because, you know, that's more, that cohort's more where Danny Ricciardo fits into, rather than the younger drivers like Alex Albon and Esteban Ocon and guys like that. Yeah, I'm not saying it can't be done.
Ocon and Albon probably aren't good comps simply because they're so much younger than Daniel Ricciardo, but maybe Magnussen and Hülkenberg are good comps simply because
I think so.
Because they're similar age and they both left the sport for involuntary reasons, where of course Fernando left the sport very much on voluntary. I think at that point he had burnt every bridge in Formula One, so maybe it wasn't necessarily a voluntary departure from Formula One, but I think K-Mag and Nico, based on their ages, is pretty similar. And I think if he could lean into what Nico did, because of course Nico has not left the world of Formula One. He's been testing in the sim, has been doing reserve driver stints. Like, he stayed close to the sport. And I think if he had left F1 entirely and chased the Indy dream or done sport car or touring car, I don't think he would have been an option. But I think the fact that he's had this physical presence in the grid and has been in and around cars, both the previous generation and the current generation, helped. So I think, while it's a break, you know, it's not going to be the 23 Grand Prix grind that I think a lot of these other drivers are going to go through next year. I just think it's incredibly valuable for him to be there, because I think there's some muscle memory and I think there are some real conditioning challenges to not being in a Formula One car for a period of 12 months. And when you're 35, 36 years old and you haven't been in a car for a year, that's a really tough sell to a team and sponsors to bring you in.
Yeah, 100%, right? Okay, time to take another break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Abu Dhabi post-season test and a bunch more things after that. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. So yes, after the season finished up last weekend, there was a little bit of testing at Yas Marina. The final day of action on the track saw two tests running concurrently at Yas Marina this past Tuesday. Each of the team provided one car for Pirelli tire testing, and they were... it was all the usual suspects, plus a bunch of the younger drivers, because a lot of the teams were also carrying out a young driver test. So the final leaderboard is interesting here. You had Carlos Sainz, Charles Leclerc, and Robert Schwartzman, who were all driving for Ferrari. Carlos's fastest time was a 125.245. He did 65 laps in the car. Charles Leclerc's fastest time was 125.383. He did 56 laps. And then Robert Schwartzman, this is impressive, a 125.4. And he did a total of 116 laps. And then you had Pierre Gasly for Alpine, Max Verstappen, Alex Albon, and Logan Sargeant, both lapping in the high 125s or the low 126s. Nick De Vries lapping in the low 126s. Nick putting in 151 laps. That is a very, very impressive amount of miles that he logged. And I think just going through the charts here, it looks like Nick De Vries put in more work than anyone else. But you look, there's some of the other young drivers. You had Liam Lawson put in a 126.281 in the Red Bull. Jack Doohan in the Alpine, a 126.297. And a name that we're looking at for next year, Oscar Piastri, said a 126.340, so about 1.1 seconds off the fastest time from Charles Leclerc. They had Felipe Drugovich in the Aston Martin, the young Brazilian, logging a 126.595. So pretty interesting stuff. Lewis Hamilton, his fastest time was a 126.75. George Russell, he was second slowest with 127.240. So there you go. I mean, of course, this is testing. I don't think you need to get too concerned that Lewis's time or George's time, and this is very much to test tire compounds and things like that for 2023.
My biggest takeaway from
anything
this? My biggest takeaway from this was the fact that Fernando Alonso was out there driving an Aston Martin, but because he's technically still on loan from Alpine, because he's technically not an Aston Martin driver yet, he did his testing in a deliveried Aston Martin. So a blank canvas, a beautiful, stunningly pearl green Aston Martin without any advertising on it. So if you get the chance and you want to go and check it out, I would encourage you to do so. And it was reminiscent of the fact that back in 2006, when he was still under contract to Renault after the season was concluded and he won the championship for Renault, he actually did the same thing, testing for McLaren while still under contract to Renault. And he did so in a McLaren that was bare of advertising and sponsorship. So that was pretty cool to see. And the only other big thing in here is, like you said, like, it's not, I think the key thing here for drivers is simply get the reps and put in as many laps as possible. The teams want the data. The drivers want the data. The drivers need the reps, especially a lot of these young drivers that are coming into the championship next year for the first time. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting was just seeing some of these drivers out there for the first time, looking at their feedback regarding the 2023 Pirelli compounds, because of course the compounds are going to be a little bit different next year. But yeah, otherwise a couple of days of winter testing. But yeah, it was good to see otherwise. And now we move in officially to the winter sessions or the winter season.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think it's interesting to see some of these times, but I was very, very impressed that that Robert Schwartzman was able to lap so closely to Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz in that Ferrari. I mean, that's very, very impressive, and I'm putting in 100-plus laps as well. Okay, next story is that apparently the Chinese Grand Prix at the Shanghai International Raceway will be canceled for next year. This has kind of been this one's been sort of popping up in the news or in the rumor mill every once in a while over the past several months. So it just seems like it's going to be inevitable now. We haven't been to China since 2019, and it seems that the China's zero COVID policy and the fact that Formula One staff would not be given exemptions from quarantine rules, and that the fact they might have to be locked down if they become test COVID positive is going to be the big issue there, because as we've seen in other parts of the world, even here in Canada, which is great news, that you know, COVID requirements now, if you test positive, are much, much different and much more lenient than even this past summer. So, I mean, things have changed. And I mean, touch wood that things continue the way that they are, because we're pretty much back to normal as we were before the pandemic all started a couple of years ago. So this would be a bit of a shame if it does come to pass. Like I said, it's considered that this is going to happen at some point. Formula One has not made any comment or any confirmations about that. And Stefano Domenicali certainly hasn't made any official announcements as well. So just seems like it's going to happen at some point. Well, who knows when?
Yeah, it's reported as well that F1 does not plan to backfill this race, that they will not be replacing it, which means as it stands, there will be a four-week break between the Australian Grand Prix and Baku, because of course that's the way the calendar had kind of initially been laid out, so there'll be a significant break. It sounds like, or at least it's being reported, that Formula One has approached the Baku race organizers and asked them to bring that race forward a week to reduce some of the time off between the two championships, or between the two Grand Prix. Baku has resisted this. So if in fact the Chinese Grand Prix gets canceled, there will be a 4-week break. The other thing that I should quickly comment on, because I didn't know where else to put this in the outlet or in the outline of the podcast today, is next year, just kind of speaking to the 2023 calendar, F1, as a reminder, is planning for sprint race weekends in Azerbaijan, in Austria, in Belgium, in Qatar, in the United States, in Austin, and Brazil. So 6 sprint races next year, but potentially an awkward 4-week gap in the calendar between Australia and Baku.
So what dates would that actually be? Because that's going to be on the front end of the season, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't immediately have those dates in front of me, but that would be a bit of a bummer. Looking on at some other news here now, Pirelli said that overtaking in 2022 is up 30% from 2021. They said after 22 races last season, there were 599 recorded overtakes in 2022. That increased to 785. So F1 chief, or Pirelli F1 chief Mario Sola, said that only proper overtakes were counted in the analysis, meaning that the numbers were not influenced by cars pitting or dropping down the order because of mechanical issues or something like that. Sola had to say, quote, "Unfortunately, it's difficult to have a statistic where if they overtake each other 2 or 3 times in a lap, like, I don't know, Jeddah or some other races, but then on the main straight, they are in the same position. You don't get this because it's too difficult. It's just real overtaking. I believe it's a very good number, 30% more, considering that is informed by the facts. So it's not exaggerated. It's quite a good point," end quote. So that's, you know, a bit of a mishmash. I'm not... A bit of an interesting quote there, but
600 overtakes in 2021 versus 785 overtakes this year. I think we can chalk that up as being a success. And of course, it's due to all the things that we talked about earlier this year, the fact that the cars are easier to follow and the underbody ground effects are creating less kind of noisy, turbulent air. Like the things that F1 promised, even if the championship itself was a little bit of a letdown this year, the building blocks that they're putting in place are are definitely working. And this kind of feeds into the next story, and I'll jump ahead of myself here, but 780 odd overtakes this season. The champion for the most overtakes, the most individual overtakes this year. And of course, these numbers are a little bit awkward because if you typically qualify well and you start at the front of the grid, you're not going to have a ton of overtaking opportunities. But Fernando Alonso finished with 71 overtakes this year, the most in Formula One, followed by Lewis Hamilton with 63, Zhou with 62, Sainz with 61, and Verstappen and Stroll tied for fifth with 57. And this is interesting as well. The most overtaken drivers of the year, Mr. Magnussen, Kevin Magnussen with 101 overtakes. Schumacher was overtaken 99 times. Latifi was overtaken 79 times. Stroll was overtaken 67 times. And Zhou was overtaken 63 times. So hopefully that contextualizes that roughly 10% of all of the overtakes that happened during the 2022 season were performed by Mr. Fernando Alonso.
That is an amazing stat. You know, that's really quite impressive when you think about it. Okay, so getting a little sort of off topic here, but apparently Red Bull's headquarters were hit by a Ukraine protest not so long ago. So they were invaded by campaigners outside Salzburg, and they unfurled a huge 400 square meter banner depicting Russian leader Vladimir Putin riding the company's famous Red Bull logo. Unlike most of the global brands, the energy drink refused to cut ties with Russia, and the caffeinated beverage is still on sale in supermarkets across the country. And this is according to an article on deadlinenews.co.uk. So interesting, eh? So apparently this was organized by a group called the Ukraine Solidarity Project. It's a network of European and Ukrainian activists that are exposing global brands like Red Bull for what they call regressive policies on Putin's Russia. So there you go.
I didn't actually realize, my friend, because of course, I think we're all very sensitive to which global brands are continuing to do business in Russia after the invasion of Ukraine earlier this year. But I was pretty surprised and very disappointed to learn that Red Bull is still very much selling their product in that country, which to me is a non-starter. And I don't mean to make this super political, but it's just really disappointing when so many global brands like Pepsi and Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Burger King and Subway and virtually every automotive manufacturer, including Mercedes, who has just exited the Russian car maker after selling off the bulk of its assets, that so many of these global brands could so quickly exit and make a statement to Vladimir Putin, the Russian government, that, hey, you know what? Invading and trying to occupy a completely sovereign neighboring state is unacceptable. It's just really disappointing that Red Bull continues to do business in this country. And this protest that you speak to, which had that gigantic 400 square meter banner with Putin riding the Red Bull with the slogan that said Red Bull gives Putin wings. This was complemented by another protest that actually happened at Red Bull's Milton Keynes factory, where a message was projected onto the side of the F1 racing headquarters with a slogan and an appeal to Max Verstappen personally to help campaign to get Red Bull out of the Russian domestic drinks market.
Yeah, there you go. I did get a chance to throw this into the show outline, so I can't speak 100% to the accuracy, but I thought I read something a little bit earlier today that Mercedes is thinking of completely removing their brand, their cars from sale in Russia. So
yeah, they're one of the few that still remains. They're one of the few that still remains. So most international global auto manufacturers have exited and sold off their assets. It's a little bit trickier, I think, for automotive brands to just pack up and go, because if you're a drinks producer, you literally have a one-time relationship with your consumer, right? They give a store a dollar and the store gives them your beverage and you sell the beverage to the stores. But when you're selling automobiles, there are lifetime contracts associated with warranties and service agreements. And of course, there's also financial obligations that typically, if you're a big-time auto manufacturer, you provide some sort of financing arrangements for consumers as well. So I think it's been a little bit more complicated. But as of, I think, October 26th, Mercedes has officially exited the Russian car market, or has almost completely exited the Russian car maker or car market, following other brands such as Nissan and Mazda and many, many others.
Amazing. Okay, so let's go now, and this is always fun to talk about, driver's salaries. So this is courtesy of Forbes.com. And they do kind of have a caveat at the end of this article where they do state that very few of the Formula One driver salaries are publicly available. So they generated their on-track compensation estimates in collaboration with one of their contributors, Caroline Reed of the Formula Money. So these estimates are based on a number of things, including financial documents, legal filings, and press leaks, as well as conversations with industry insiders, and are rounded up or down to the nearest million. So coming in at number one is no surprise here, the two-time world champion, Max Verstappen, at $60 million. Lewis Hamilton, number two, at $55 million. Then a big drop-off after Max and Lewis. Then third is Fernando at $30 million. Sergio Perez, $26 million. Charles Leclerc, $23 million. And then a bit of a drop off again after Charles. Sebastian Vettel is took home $17 million, as did Danny Ricciardo. Carlos Sainz, $15 million. And then rounding out in ninth and tenth, Lando Norris took home $11 million this past year. And then George Russell, fitting that he's at number 10, considering he brought home a $10 million salary this past year. Hammy, thoughts on that? I guess it's no real surprise that that who's at the top, but I must admit, I was a bit surprised to see Fernando at $30 billion at Alpine this past year. That was a bit of a wow moment.
To me as well, my friend, like when I look at this list, I'm not surprised to see former world champions making a lot of money, but Fernando, of course, sure, on the wrong side of 40 and kind of racking up Grand Prix after Grand Prix to still be making tens of millions of dollars is pretty remarkable. And it's funny too, because in hindsight, it might make more sense now why the Alpine board was somewhat reluctant to commit to a 40 plus year old driver with a deal worth tens of millions of dollars per year, especially when Lawrence Stroll was willing to make that commitment over a multi-year agreement. Kind of makes sense. But again, especially in Formula One, all the power to these drivers for negotiating as much possible money as they can. We know these teams are absolutely swimming in sponsorship money and prize money from the Constructors' Championship. I would rather see the drivers earn this money than anybody else. They are literally the ones on the track risking their life and limb every single practice session, every single qualifying session, and every single Grand Prix. So it's great to see that they can monetize this experience as well. And kudos to Max Verstappen, two-time world champion. Salary, like you said, $40 million with bonuses of $20 million. And of course, Lewis Hamilton, once again, in the top two, the top three at $55 million. And you and I have talked about the fact that, look, Lewis Hamilton's going to continue to earn $50 plus million a year for as long as he wants to commit to Formula One. So when we talk about him staying for another 3 or 4 or 5 years, that could be $250 million in race earnings, not to mention the associated sponsorships. There's apparently 250 million reasons for Lewis Hamilton to stay in Formula One. So it's great to see the drivers earn as much as they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, why don't we take one final break, and then we come back. Still got a couple more fun stories to talk about, so we'll do that in a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. Still a couple more things to talk about this week, but before we wrap it up, first one is a quote from Alpine team principal Otmar Szafnauer, who said, quote, "I'm happy that our driver pairing with Esteban and Pierre is better than it would have been if we would have won that case." End quote. So when he means that case, he means that Oscar Piastri case. So that's kind of an interesting quote. And I think that they do have a very, very solid driver pairing with Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon. And when it came down to it, excuse me, you know, if you had Oscar Piastri, like, why would you fight to keep him? I think it was all legal wrangling just to make sure that they got the proper financial compensation, because do you really want to force a guy to stay that doesn't obviously want to be there in the long run.
Is it just me, my friend, or has the reputation of Otmar really taken a hit since he left Aston Martin? And so much of it is related to the fact that Fernando left that organization and he didn't know or wasn't informed or was the last person at Alpine to find out. Of course, they announced that Oscar's going to be driving for them when, of course, he'd already negotiated a deal with Mercedes, and that was a terrible look for this team. And now with a comment like he just seems super petty. And I quote again, "I'm happy that our driver pairing with Esteban and Pierre is better than it would have been if we had won that quote or that Piastri case," and of course Piastri in brackets. But see, it sounds very, very, very defensive and very bitter. But it's amazing what a hit his reputation has taken since he left Aston Martin, because I think we all reflected glowingly on his career, because of course he was the one that very much stewarded that very much budget Force India operation for many, many years and helped them climb to fourth in the constructors one specific year. So it's unfortunate that that his reputation has taken such a hit, at least in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was kind of funny. I mean, the way that I saw this quote was I took it from a bit of a different angle. I was just like, well, okay, are you sort of based on this or basing this on the fact that, it's kind of like, Pierre and Esteban are known quantities within Formula One, where Piastri is still yet to prove himself in the sport. But yeah, that is kind
of interesting. I stand by the what you said is perfectly logical, but I like the juicy interpretation that I have.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I'm not going to try and convince you otherwise. I'm just saying that I did actually take it from that point of view. But when you kind of lay it out that way, that certainly is a very, very interesting perspective, because it has not really been a good year for Otmar Szafnauer. Because I mean, when he was at Racing Point / Force India, I mean, that was like a team that always did more with less, and I think he was kind of, he really stood out as at least in my mind, as somebody that did an exceptionally good job for a team that didn't really have a lot of resources, and they had some good results with it. So sticking with Fernando Alonso, so he now feels 100% plus happy with his move to Aston Martin. So you talked about a little bit earlier when we were just talking about Abu Dhabi. We talked about it off the beginning of the show here. Anyways, Fernando said that he was, quote, happily surprised by everything, end quote. And then he further on went to say, quote, "This year's car is not anywhere near of what we will run next year. It was not really to get confident or anything like that. It's not to get going to be a continuation of this car or anything like that. For sure, they had a very strong weekend here. Sebastian Vettel qualified in front of me, so I don't think it was much of a difference between Aston Martin and Alpine on the weekend. I felt basically the same as well. I felt a very competitive car. Both Aston Martins finished in the points, so it was a good car anyway." So, Hammy, now's your opportunity. You had some stuff you wanted to say about Fernando Alonso, you wanted to say and Aston Martin. So now's your time to
Haley,
shine.
I think this is going to be the ultimate test, the ultimate challenge for young Lance Stroll. And well, I keep saying young Lance Stroll, but he's been in Formula One for 2017 since the 2017 season. He has 122 Grand Prix race starts. It's remarkable how long he's been in Formula One. Despite all of that, though, he scored just the three podiums. He had obviously that remarkable Baku podium in Azerbaijan back in 2017, and he had a couple of podiums during the COVID shortened season in 2020. But this is the guy that I find to be probably the most frustrating guy in Formula One. And I am very firmly living on Lance Stroll Island, because I believe the talent is there. But I just, if a pairing with Fernando Alonso can't take it out of him, can't pull that talent, those performances out of him, I don't know what will. And I'm still strongly of the mind that Lawrence Stroll was very strategic in bringing Sebastian Vettel to that team. And it was in part because Sebastian Vettel adds a tremendous amount of value in terms of developing the car. He adds a substantial amount of value to the team from a marketing perspective as a two-time world champion. But I also think it was because they wanted Lance to be able to see his work ethic, how he approaches races, how he prepares, and be able to read into his telemetry and a lot of his data. I don't know that necessarily came to bear the way that they were hoping that it would. And of course, Lance Stroll went from 13th in the constructor standings in 21 to 15th this year. Of course, finished the season with a couple of points finishes, but had as many disappointing moments this year as he had really exciting and terrific, well-executed moments. But I feel like pairing him with Fernando Alonso is either going to bring the best out of Lance Stroll or possibly put us in a position where we're talking about how much runway does Lance Stroll have left in Formula One after the 2023 championship. Because I have every reason to believe that Fernando Alonso will wring every ounce of performance out of that 2023 Aston Martin. And you and I have been buying, not literally, but you and I have been buying so much Aston Martin stock for the last 2 years, partly because we're mesmerized by the beauty of that green, that British Racing green Aston Martin, but also because I think we buy into what Lawrence Stroll is doing with that project, which is investing tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into the factory and the team and investing in the road car division. Like, I'm sold on all of that. It hasn't manifested itself in the form of a really great Formula One racing car. And I have to think that while 21 was a disappointment and 22 was a disappointment with all the expectations that we had for that car, you got to think they're going to turn a corner, no pun intended, in 23 and deliver a great car. And I have every confidence that Fernando Alonso is going to be able to deliver some exceptional performances. And if he does, it's going to put the spotlight firmly on Lance if he's not mirroring Fernando's performances.
Yeah, it is going to be an interesting dynamic to watch with that team in 2023. Fernando and Lance obviously at very, very different points in their career, and Lance has had the benefit of being with this team now for more than a couple of years and has kind of seen this car evolve, and it's just going to be interesting to watch, because Fernando doesn't have a great track record of, you know, getting along well with his teammates. And if anybody's going to be in it for the long haul at this team, it's going to be Lance compared to Fernando, right? And it's just, it kind of goes back to that, the comment from Connie earlier, and she was saying, what's the over on under before the relationship between Lance and Fernando goes toxic? And you were like winter testing it. I mean, that's only like half joking, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of seriousness in that comment. Okay, couple more things we wanted to talk on. So another one is an article from therace.com, and this is 5 reasons Williams had given Logan Sargeant in F1. The first one is, and the first two are driver related because they lost out on Oscar Piastri and Nick De Vries. The third one was Williams wanting to back their own. So this is basically promoting one of their own drivers. And then he's got a big upside on and off the track. So let's start with the first two. They lost out on Oscar Piastri, and then Nick De Vries went to AlphaTauri. So do you think that, where do you think, compared to Piastri and De Vries, where do you think Logan Sargeant sort of falls into that picture? Is it just because he was basically the last person left standing after those other two, and kind of that he was, I guess, I wouldn't want to say forced into the spotlight, but it was just kind of in the spotlight for them because he was the only one left, right?
It's kind of a case of musical chairs, and ultimately he was the last driver standing. And like you said, this team, Williams, had designs and intentions of bringing Piastri in. That was always the plan, because the assumption was, or the expectation was, that Alpine was going to re-sign Fernando Alonso. And of course, that all went topsy-turvy as soon as Fernando signed with Aston Martin. And then, of course, the assumption at that point was De Vries, who was a Mercedes reserve driver and actually did a stint, that remarkable stint in the Williams car at Monza, the assumption was that he was going to get the ride. And of course, he caught the attention of Red Bull, and Red Bull was able to put a really attractive offer in front of him to go to AlphaTauri. So suddenly those two drivers were no longer options. Now, the reality is Logan Sargeant is an American driver. So this could be hugely beneficial to Williams from a marketing perspective. And it's going to be incredibly exciting to see how receptive the American audience is to an American driver who doesn't have the cachet as somebody like Colton Herta, because Colton Herta is a household name in the United States because he's been winning at a high level. Logan Sargeant has been working away as a member of the Williams Driver Academy. He competed in Formula 3. He finished third in the championship in 2020, the year Oscar Piastri won the F3 championship. He finished fourth in the Formula 2 championship. So Williams always had intentions to mold him into a driver that would be equipped to drive a Williams Formula 1 racing car. So this shouldn't be totally surprising. And it's good to see an academy rewarding a young driver. Interestingly, this occurred to me earlier today as well. He is now the third successive young North American driver that this team has picked up that comes from a billionaire family, because of course Lance Stroll went there in 2017, billionaire family. Of course, Nicholas Latifi went there in 2020, billionaire family. And Logan Sargeant himself comes from a billionaire family. And his older brother Dalton, is also a known quantity in the world of motorsports because he's competed in some stock car championships. Not in the last couple of years, but he has competed professionally in stock car championships. So all of that aside, he's done his reps in the lower formulas. He competed well in Formula 3. He competed well in Formula 2. I think ideally, if given the choice, I think Williams would like to have seen him have another year, another 20 races in Formula 2. That said, it wasn't an option and they had a need. Go for it, because it could make this team really attractive to American sponsors to have a young American driver in that seat.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I really didn't know too much about Logan Sargeant, and I had no idea what the about his background. But it's interesting, like you're saying that billionaire connection has kind of like really popped up between Williams and some of these drivers. Especially, I mean, now it's even more irrelevant than it was in the past, right? Because you have the cost cap, and like you were saying earlier, especially like in the lower formulas, like Formula 2, Formula 3, they're all essentially.
I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if he's bringing funding. Like when Lance Stroll was Williams, that was a pay driver role. His dad brought a ton of funding to that team. When Nicholas Latifi was with that team, his dad brought a ton of funding to that team. With Logan Sargeant, I'm not totally convinced that Logan Sargeant is bringing any funding to that team. And I think given the fact that he's actually come through their driver academy, I think he's very much there on merit. Because like you and I have talked about so much, my friend, the era of pay drivers at the Formula One level is just irrelevant now, because with the cost cap, there's just so much more parity when it comes to funding the Formula One operations, that if you're only $150 million mm-hmm. out of pocket for the bulk of your expenses, you don't need to rely on a subpar, less than stellar Formula One driver just because they're bringing $20 or $30 million of funding. Like, that's just not something that's relevant anymore. And if you're picking a driver based on them bringing funding, then you're just making a bad business and bad sporting decision.
Yeah, interesting, right? And then the final point written by the author of this article, Scott Mitchell Malm, is that he's got big upsides on the track, both on the track and off it. And specifically, he's referring to Logan is American, the fact that the sport has just been growing in leaps and bounds in the USA over the past couple of years. How important do you think that is to Williams that Logan is an up and coming American driver?
I think it's very,
even one that I was just gonna say that even though, considering he's not like a household name, like say Colton Herta was the other American that was linked with Formula One this year.
Man,
so sorry, Hammy, you gotta jump back in.
Let's
here.
Jump back 7 years. I think a lot of people thought Alexander Rossi was going to be huge for Formula One in America, and it didn't make any difference. Of course, that said, it was during an era when the US Grand Prix was on the verge of disappearing from the calendar, and there were no eyeballs on live Formula One TV broadcast in the US, and I think it was on NBC Sportsnet at that point. But I think that's Logan's uncle's name. I think Logan's entering at the right time, but I'm still not convinced that for Formula One to succeed in the United States, it needs an American driver at all. I think it's nice to have one, but mm-hmm. I think it's also important that that young driver show flashes of brilliance and be put in a situation where he can be successful. And Logan's a talented young driver for sure. I think we very much need to treat this year as his I don't know, sophomore year of Formula 2, because he only had that 1 year of reps in Formula 2. But I also worry because what has Williams shown us in the past 4 or 5 years to give any confidence in their ability to develop a great car? And maybe by the time they have a really great car, he's at the end of his runway anyway. So I wish him the best. I wish him a ton of success. And I do believe for Williams, which remember, Doralton is an American-based firm, right? That this is a company that has deep-pocketed American owners, even if they've not chosen to exercise their credit card with great regularity. I think it will be important for them, and it will help them broaden their appeal marketing-wise in the United States.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting, right? But I'm excited anytime you see like a new young driver coming into the sport, regardless where they're from. There's a couple of exceptions to that, but certainly interested to see what Logan will do in and out of the car. So finally, there's you put this one in. So there was a bit of a Twitter thread here from Mika Schumacher, now the former Haas driver. Let me just read this whole thread out. So Mick had to say, the 2022 season has come to an end, and with that, a chapter as well. I want to take this moment to thank everyone at Haas F1 for all their hard work over the last 2 years. I've been able to meet incredible people and build friendships that I will cherish for life. But I also want to thank you guys out there, my followers, friends, and obviously family, for supporting me through thick and thin. You motivate me day in and day out to push further and to be a better person than I was yesterday. I don't know yet what next year will bring, but I'll know I'll work harder than ever to come back stronger and be the best version of myself. Thank you. So there you go. So you've added in here to the show notes, talk about incredibly awkward moment of MSC being scolded for doing donuts.
Did you see that after the race?
Yes.
Oh, that was so embarrassing.
I saw him doing the donuts. I saw the donuts, but
Did you hear that?
I saw the donuts.
You didn't hear the radio?
No.
Oh, man.
I didn't.
After the race, as we see in Abu Dhabi, there's a moment and it's actually choreographed and drivers typically know where to go, where to position themselves, but drivers will typically go and do donuts. And it's a tradition for champions to do donuts, and it's a tradition for those drivers that are exiting the sports to do donuts. It's a way to celebrate their time. It's a great show for the fans. So Mick's out there doing donuts, and his Haas engineer comes on the radio and promptly scolds him for doing donuts and asks him to immediately stop. and so Mick complies and kind of sheepishly, with his kind of tail between his legs, heads back to the pits. But his response to the scolding was, okay, I love you too. So it was a very unceremonious way for him to end his two-year journey with Haas. And it was funny, Haas received so much heat because of this. The fact that they couldn't let him enjoy potentially his final moments in a Formula One car without getting on the radio and blasting him in public. They came out later with some technical explanations for the fact that, hey, you know what? In the event that you're doing donuts, there's always the danger that in a moment of inattention, concentration is lacking. There could be strain on the gearbox. There could be strain on the clutch. There could be damage to the car, blah, 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 blah. Ultimately, it just showed that Haas are ultimately massive cheapskates, and they couldn't let Mick enjoy his final moments in a Haas Formula One car for fear that he was going to damage the gearbox or the transmission, which is total BS. So it was unfortunate to see. Mick, we're going to miss you. You're a great kid. And I think on behalf of the Scuderi F1 podcast, we would love to see you in F1 again with a much more competitive car and a team that knows how to nurture a young driver with a great racing pedigree.
Yeah, I mean, it seems kind of funny for them to be scolding him and saying all those things about, like, the strain on the car, the gearbox, the engine. It's like, who cares? These cars are
relevant, that's exactly right? The thing. Like, none of this is going to be carried over to next year. What are they trying to preserve?
Yeah, I don't know. Are they going to try and, like, take this car apart and, like, start using something on it? Like, I don't know, like strips of tape or some screws bolts? Or something?
They're literally harvesting the screws for use next year.
Scraping the stickers off the side of the sidebots.
Save it for 23, yeah.
Oh my goodness. There you go. All right, Hammy. I think that's about all we got for this week. So on behalf of myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, thank you for a wonderful season. Like Mark said off the top of the show, the off-topic show is coming on Sunday or Monday. Plus, we'll have to do a season wrap at some point to give it a little bit of sort of time to kind of breathe and get a little bit of space after the end of the season. But we have to go back and do a proper recap and talk about some of my some of our ups and downs and highs and lows and all the good and the bad of the season. So we'll do that very, very soon. And as Mark always says, but I'm not going to give him a chance this week, if you could leave us a 5-star rating review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc., that really does make a world of difference. Oh, you're going to jump
one
in.
One thing. You did a great job. But one thing. Steve in the live chat just made a really great point, and he says that they, being Haas, might have needed that car for winter testing. And as I understand it, Haas didn't in fact have any spare transmissions or clutches with them. I believe I might be wrong. So they were in fact possibly trying to preserve the car because they didn't have any spare parts or didn't want to spend the money on the spare parts that would have been necessary to fix it if he had broken it. So again, still shame on Haas, but Steve makes a really great point.
He does. Yeah.
Totally. Cool.
But we'll still bash them for being spoil sports. So
100%. There's that.
That's how we're rolling this week. Anyways, again, thank you all to one and all for listening to the show. If you want to get in touch, do so on Twitter at @ScooteryF1Pod or send us an email, ScooteryF1Pod@gmail.com. Everyone in the live chat, thank you for hanging out, and we'll see you guys again in a couple of days. And again, last moments of Thanksgiving. Enjoy that. Enjoy Black Friday. Enjoy all the leftovers. And we'll talk to you again in a couple of days. Bye for now.